Chapter 16. "He's coming round," a voice said, crystallizing my sluggish thoughts towards consciousness. One of the things you learnt as a soldier, at least on Sky's Edge, was that not everyone who shot you necessarily wanted to kill you, at least not immediately. There were reasons for this, not all of them to do with the usual mechanics of hostage-taking. Memories could be trawled from captured soldiers without the crudities of torture. All it required was the kind of neural imaging technology which Ultras could supply, at a price, and for there to be something worth learning in the first place. Intelligence, in other words, the kind of operational knowledge which soldiers must know if they are to have any value at all. But it had never happened to me. I had been shot at and hit, but on all the occasions when it happened, no one had been intending that I live, for even the relatively short length of time that it would take to winnow my memories. I had never been captured by the enemy, and so had never had the dubious pleasure of waking to find myself in anything other than safe hands. Now, though, I was learning exactly how it felt. "Mr. Mirabelle, are you awake?" Someone wiped something soft and cold across my face. I opened my eyes and squinted against light, which was painfully bright after my period of unconsciousness. "Where am I?"
"Somewhere safe."
I looked around blearily. I was in a chair at the high end of a long, sloping room. On either side of me, the fluted metal walls angled downwards, as if I were descending an escalator down a gently angled tunnel. The walls were punctured by oval windows, but I couldn't see much except darkness ribboned with long chains of tangled fairy lights. I was high above the surface of the city, then almost certainly in some part of the canopy. The floor consisted of a series of horizontal surfaces which descended towards the low end of the room, which must have been 15 meters away and 2 or 3 meters below me. They looked like they'd been added on afterwards, as if the room's slope was not quite intentional. I wasn't alone, of course. The square-jawed man with the monocle was standing next to me, one hand toying with his chin, as if he needed to keep reminding himself of its magnificent rectilinearity. In his other hand was a limp flannel, the means by which I had been so gently assisted towards consciousness. "I've got to hand it to you," the man said. "I miscalculated the dose in that stun beam. It would have killed some people, and I expected you to be out cold for a good few hours more." Then he placed a hand on my shoulder. "But you're fine, I think. A pretty strong fellow. You'll have to accept my apologies. It won't happen again, I assure you."
"You'd better not do it again," said the woman who had just stepped into my field of vision. I recognized her, of course, and her companion, who hove into view on my right, pushing a cigarette to his lips. "You're getting sloppy, Waverley. This man must have thought you were planning to kill him."
"That wasn't the idea," I said, finding that I sounded nowhere near as slurred as I had been expecting. Waverley shook his head gravely. "Not at all. I was doing my best to save your life, Mr. Mirabelle."
"You've a pretty funny way of going about it."
"I had to act quickly. You were about to be ambushed by a group of pigs. Do you know about pigs, Mr. Mirabelle? You probably don't want to. They're one of the less salubrious immigrant groups we've had to deal with since the fall of the Glitter Band. They had arranged a tripwire across the roadway connected to a crossbow. Normally they don't stalk anyone until later in the evening, but they must have been hungry tonight."
"What did you shoot me with?"
"Like I said, a stun beam. Quite a humane weapon, really. The laser beam is only a precursor. It establishes an ionized path through the air, down which a paralyzing electrical flux can be discharged."
"It's still painful."
"I know, I know." He raised his hands defensively. "I've taken a few hits myself. I'm afraid I had it calibrated to stun a pig rather than human, but perhaps it was for the best. You'd have resisted me if I hadn't put you under so comprehensively, I suspect."
"Why did you save me anyway?"
He looked put out. "It was the decent thing to do, I'd have thought." Now the woman spoke.
"At first I misjudged you, Mr. Mirabelle. You put me on edge, and I didn't trust you completely."
"All I did was ask for some advice."
"I know. The fault's all mine. But we're all so nervous these days. After we'd left, I felt bad about it and told Waverley to keep an eye on you, which is what he did."
"An eye? Yes, Sibylline," Waverley said.
"And where would here happen to be?" I said.
Show him, Waverley. He must want to stretch his legs by now.
I'd half expected to have been secured to the chair, but I was free to move. Waverley offered me a supporting arm while I tested the usefulness of my legs. The muscle in the leg where the beam had touched still felt like jelly, but it was just about able to support me. I stepped past the woman, descending the series of level surfaces until I'd reached the lowest part of the room. At that end, there was a pair of double doors which opened onto the night air. Waverley led me onto a sloping balcony bounded by a metal railing. Warm air slapped against my face. I looked back. The balcony surrounded the building where I had awoken, rising up on either side of it, but the building wasn't really a building. It was the gondola of an airship, tipped up at an angle. Above us, the craft's gas bag was a dark mass, pinned between the branches of the canopy. The airship must have been trapped here when the plague hit, caught like a balloon in a tree. The gas bag was so impermeable that it was still fully inflated, 7 years after the plague. But it was crimped and distorted by the pressure of the branches which had formed around it, and I couldn't help wondering how strong it really was, and what would happen to the gondola if the bag was punctured. "It must have happened really fast," I said, having visions of the airship trying to steer itself out of the path of the malforming building. "Not that quickly," Waverley said, as if I'd said something deeply foolish. "This was a sightseeing airship. There were dozens of them back in the old days. When the trouble came, no one was much interested in sightseeing any more. They left the airship moored here while the building grew around it, but it still took a day or so for the branches to trap it completely."
"And now you live in it?"
"Well, not exactly. It isn't all that safe, really. That's why we don't have to worry too much about anyone else paying us any attention." Behind, the door swung open again and the woman emerged.
"An unorthodox place to wake you, I admit."
She joined Waverley next to the railing, leaning bravely over the edge. It must have been an easy kilometer to the ground, but it does have its uses, discretion being one of them. "Now then, Mr. Mirabel, I expect you are in need of some good food and hospitality. Am I right?" I nodded, thinking that if I stayed with these people, they might provide a means for me to enter the canopy proper. That was the rational argument for agreeing. The other part was born out of sheer relief and gratitude, and the fact that I was as tired and hungry as she probably imagined. "I don't want to impose."
"Nonsense. I did you a great disservice in the mulch, and then Waverley rather compounded the error with his ham-fisted stun setting, didn't you, Waverley? Well, we'll say no more of it, provided you do us the honour of providing you with a little food and rest."
The woman took something black out of a pocket, folding it open and elongating an aerial before speaking into it.
"Darling, we're ready now. We'll meet at the high end of the gondola."
She snapped the telephone shut and pushed it back into her pocket. We walked around the side of the gondola, using the railing to haul our way up the slope without slipping. At the highest point, the railing had been cut away, so that there was nothing between me and the ground except a lot of air. Waverley and Sibylline, if that was her name, could have easily pushed me over the edge had either of them meant me any harm, especially in my generally disorientated state. More than that, they'd had plenty of opportunities to do it before I woke up. "Here he comes," Waverley said, pointing under the sagging curve of the gas bag. I watched a cable car descend into view. It looked a lot like the one I'd first seen Sibylline in, but I wasn't pretending to be an expert just yet. The car's arms grasped threads entangled around the gas bag, tugging the blimp out of shape, but managing not to puncture it. The car came close, its door opening and a ramp extending out to bridge the gap to the gondola.
"After you, Tanner," Sibylline said.
I crossed the bridge. It was only a step of a meter or so, but there was no protection on either side, and it took an effort of nerve to make the crossing. Sibylline and Waverley followed me blithely. Living in the canopy must have given everyone an inhuman head for heights. There were four seats in the rear compartment, and a windowed partition between us and the driver. Before the window was closed, I saw that the driver was the high-cheek-boned, grey-eyed man who had been with Sibylline earlier.
"Where are you taking me?" I said.
"To eat? Where else?" Sibylline placed a hand on my forearm trustingly. "The best place in the city, Tanner. Certainly the place with the best view." A nighttime flight across Chasm City. With only the lights to trace the geometry of the city, it was almost possible to pretend that the plague hadn't happened. The shapes of the buildings were lost in the darkness, except where the upper branches were picked out by tentacles and star streams of glowing windows, or the neon scribbles of advertisements, whose meaning I couldn't fathom, spelt in the cryptic ideograms of Canadian. Now and then we would pass one of the older buildings that hadn't been affected by the plague, standing stiff and regular amongst the changed ones. More often than not, those buildings were still damaged, even if they hadn't been caused to physically mutate. Other adjacent structures had thrust limbs through their neighbors, or undermined their foundations. Some had wrapped themselves around other buildings like strangler vines. There had been fires, explosions, and riots during the days of the plague, and very little had emerged from those times completely unscathed. "You see that one?" Sibylline said, drawing my attention to a pyramid shape which was more or less intact. It was a very low structure, almost lost in the mulch, but it was picked out by searchlights arcing down from above. "That's the monument to the 80. I assume you know the story?" "Not in any detail." "It was a long time ago. This man tried to scan people into computers, but the technology wasn't mature. They were killed by the scanning process, which was bad enough, but then the simulation started to go wrong. There were 80 of them, including the man himself. When it was all over, when most of them had failed, their families had that monument built. But it's seen better days now." "Like the Hell City," Waverley said. We continued across town. Traveling by cable car took a little getting used to, as my stomach was discovering. When the car was passing through a place where there were many threads, the ride was almost as smooth and level as a volantor. But as soon as the thread started to thin out, as the car traversed the parts of the canopy where there were no major branches, for instance, the trajectory became a lot less crow-like and a lot more gibbon-like, wide stomach-churning arcs punctuated by jolts of upward thrust. It should have felt very natural, given that the human brain was supposed to have evolved for exactly this kind of arboreal living. But that was a few too many million years ago for me. Eventually the cable car's sickening arcs took us down towards ground level. I remembered Quirinbach telling me the locals referred to the city's great merge dome as the mosquito net, and here it reached down until it touched the ground near the chasm's rim. In this inner perimeter region, the vertical stratification of the city was less pronounced. There was an intermingling of canopy and mulch, an indeterminate zone where the mulch reached up to brush the underneath of the dome, and places where the canopy forced itself underground, into armored plazas where the wealthy could walk unmolested. It was into one of those enclaves that Sibylline's driver took us, dropping the cable car's undercarriage and steering the craft onto a landing deck where other cars were parked. The edge of the dome was a sloping, stained brown wall, leaning over us like a breaking wave. Through the parts which were still more or less transparent, the huge wide maw of the chasm was visible, the city on the other side of it only a distant forest of twinkling lights. "I've called ahead and booked us a table at the Stork," said the man with the iron grey eyes, stepping out of the car's driving compartment. "Word is Voronov's going to be eating there tonight, so the place is pretty packed."
"I'm pleased," Sibylline said. "You can always rely on Voronov to add a little gloss to the evening."
Casually she opened a compartment in the side of the car and pulled out a black purse, opening it to reveal little vials of dream fuel and one of the ornate wedding guns I'd seen aboard the Strelnikov. She tugged down her collar and pressed the gun against her neck, gritting her teeth as she shunted a cubic centimeter of the dark red fluid into her bloodstream. Then she passed the gun to her partner, who injected himself before returning the baroquely ornamental instrument to Sibylline.
"Tanner," she said, "do you want a spike?"
"I'll pass," I said.
"Fine."
She folded the kit away in the compartment, as if what had taken place was of no particular consequence. We left the car and walked across the landing deck to a sloping ramp, which led down into a brightly lit plaza. It was a lot less squalid than any part of the city I'd seen so far. Clean, cool, and packed with wealthy-looking people, palanquins, servitors, and bioengineered animals. Music pulsed from the walls, which were tuned to show city scenes from before the plague. A strange, spindly robot made its way down the thoroughfare, towering over people on its blade-like legs. It was made entirely out of sharp, gleaming surfaces, like a collection of enchanted swords.
"That's one of Seekward's automata," said the man with the iron grey eyes. "He used to work in the Glitter Band, one of the leading figures in the Gluonist movement. Now he makes these things. They're very dangerous, so watch out."
We stepped gingerly around the machine, avoiding the slow arcs of its lethal limbs.
"I don't think I caught your name," I said to the man.
He looked at me oddly, as if I'd just asked him his shoe size.
"Fischetti."
We made our way down the thoroughfare, bypassing another automaton much like the first one, except this robot had distinct red stains on some of its limbs. Then we passed over a series of ornamental ponds, where plump gold and silver koi were mouthing near the surface. I tried to work out where we were. We'd landed near the chasm, and had been walking all the time towards it, but it had appeared much closer to begin with. Finally, the thoroughfare widened out into a huge domed chamber, large enough for the 100 or so dining tables it must have contained. The place was nearly full. I even saw a few palanquins parked around one table, which had been neatly set out for diners, but I couldn't see how they were going to eat. A series of steps led down to the chamber's glass floor, and then we were escorted to a vacant table at the edge of the room, next to one of the huge windows set into the chamber's midnight blue dome. An astonishingly intricate chandelier hung from the dome's apex.
"Like I said, best view in Chasm City," Sibylline said.
I could see where we were now. The restaurant was at one end of a stalk, which emerged from the side of the chasm, 50 or 60 meters from the top. The stalk must have been a kilometer long, as thin and brittle-looking as a sliver of blown glass. It was supported at the chasm end by a bracket of filigreed crystal, the effect of which was to make the rest of it look even more perilous. Sibylline passed me a menu.
"Choose what you like, Tanner, or let me choose for you if you aren't familiar with our cuisine. I won't let you leave here without a good meal."
I looked at the prices, wondering if my eye was adding a zero or two to each figure. "I can't pay for this."
"No one's asking you to. This is one we all owe you."
I made some choices, consulted with Sibylline, and then sat back and waited for the food. I felt out of place, of course, but then again I was hungry, and by staying with these people I'd learn a lot more about canopy life. Luckily I wasn't required to make small talk. Sibylline and Fischetti were talking about other people, occasionally spotting someone across the room who they pointed out discreetly. Waverley butted in now and again with an observation, but at no point was my opinion solicited except out of occasional politeness. I looked around the room, sizing up the clientele. Even the people who had reshaped their bodies and faces looked beautiful, like charismatic actors wearing animal costumes. Sometimes it was just the color of their skin that they had changed, but in others their whole physiology had been shifted towards some lean animal ideal. I saw a man with elaborate striped spines radiating from his forehead, sitting next to a woman whose enlarged eyes were periodically veiled behind iridescent lids patterned like moth's wings. There was an otherwise normal-looking man whose mouth opened to reveal a forked black tongue, which he stuck out at every opportunity, as if tasting the air. There was a slender, nearly naked woman covered in black and white stripes. She caught my eye for an instant, and I suspect she would have held her gaze had I not looked away. Instead, I looked down into the steaming depths of the chasm beneath us, my sense of vertigo slowly abating. Though it was nighttime, there was a ghostly reflected glow of the city all around us. We were a kilometer out from one wall, but the chasm was easily 15 or 20 kilometers wide, the other side appearing just as distant as it had from the landing deck. The walls were mostly sheer, except for occasional narrow natural ledges where rock had fallen away from the sides. Sometimes there were buildings set into the ledges, connected to the higher levels by elevator tubes or enclosed walkways. There was no sign of the bottom of the chasm. The walls rose from a placid white cloud layer, which hid the lower depths completely. Pipes stretched down into the mist, reaching towards the atmospheric processing machinery which I knew to be down there. The hidden machine supplied Chasm City with power, air, and water, and were robust enough to have continued functioning even after the plague had hit. I could see luminous things flying down in the depths, tiny bright triangles of color.
Gliders, Sibylline said, watching my gaze. It's an old sport. I used to do it, but the thermals are insane near the walls.
And the amount of breathing gear you have to wear? She shook her head.
The worst thing is the mist, though. You get a speed buzz from flying just above the mist level, but as soon as you drop into it, you lose all sense of direction.
If you're lucky, you head upwards and you make clear air before you run into the wall. If you're not, you think down is up and you head into higher and higher pressure, until you cook yourself alive. Or you get to add some interesting new coloration to the side of the chasm.
Radar doesn't work in the mist?
It does. But that wouldn't make it any fun, would it?
The food came. I ate cautiously, not wanting to make an exhibition of myself. It was good, too. Sibylline said the best food was still grown in orbit and shipped down by Behemoth. That explained the extra zeros after almost every item.
Look, Waverly said when we were on the final course. That's Voronoff, isn't it?
He was pointing discreetly across the room to where a man had just stood up from one of the tables.
Yes, Fischetti said, with a smile of self-congratulation. I knew he'd be here somewhere.
I looked at the man they were talking about. He was probably one of the least ostentatious people in the room, a small, immaculate-looking man with neatly curled black hair and the pleasingly neutral face of a mime artist.
Who is he? I said. I've heard of him, but I'm not sure where.
Voronoff's a celebrity, Sibylline said. She was touching my arm again, divulging another confidence. He's a hero to some of us. He's one of the oldest post-mortals. He's done everything, mastered every game.
He's some kind of game player.
More than that, Waverly said. He's into every extreme situation you can imagine. He makes the rules. The rest of us just follow.
I hear he's got something planned for tonight, said Fischetti.
Sibylline clapped her hands together.
A mist jump?
I think our luck could be in. Why else would he come here to eat? He must be bored shitless of the view.
Voronoff was walking away from his table, accompanied by a man and a woman who had been sitting with him. Everyone in the room was watching them now, sensing that something was about to happen. Even the palanquins had turned. I watched the three of them leave the room, but the air of anticipation remained. After a few minutes I understood why. Voronoff and the others had appeared on a ring-shaped balcony around the outside of the restaurant, encircling its dome. They were wearing protective clothes and masks, their faces almost hidden.
"Are they going to fly gliders?" I said.
"No," Sibylline answered. "That's entirely passé as far as Voronoff's concerned. A mist jump's something much, much more dangerous."
Now they were fitting glowing harnesses around their waists. I strained to get a better view. Each harness was attached to a coiled line of rope, the other end of which was anchored to the side of the dome. By now half the diners had crowded over to this side of the restaurant for a better view.
"You see that coil?" Sibylline said. "It's up to each jumper to calculate the length and elasticity of their line. Then they have to time the moment that they jump, based on their knowledge of the thermals in the chasm. See how they're paying close attention to what the gliders are doing down below?"
That was when the woman jumped over the edge. She must have decided that the moment was right for her leap. Through the floor I watched her drop, dwindling to a tiny human speck as she fell towards the mist. The coil was almost invisibly thin as she dragged it behind her.
"What's the idea?" I said.
"It's supposed to be pretty exciting," Fischetti said, "but the real trick is to fall enough to enter the mist, to disappear completely from view. But you don't want to fall too much, and even if you calculate the right length of line, you can still get creamed by thermals."
"She's misjudged," Sibylline said. "Oh, silly girl. She's getting sucked closer and closer to that outcrop."
I watched the glowing dot of the falling woman ram against the side of the chasm. There was a moment of stunned silence in the restaurant, as if the unspeakable had happened. I was expecting the silence to be broken by cries of horror and pity. Instead, there was a polite round of applause, and some muted sounds of commiseration.
"I could have told her that was going to happen," Sibylline said.
"Who was she?" Fischetti said.
"I don't know. Olivia, something or other. Sibylline picked up the menu again and began scanning the desserts.
Careful, you'll miss the next one. I think it's going to be Voronov.
Yes. Fischetti hammered the table as his hero stepped off the balcony and dropped gracefully towards the mist. See how cool he was? That's class, that is.
Voronov fell like an expert swimmer, his line as straight and true as if he were plunging through vacuum. It was all a matter of timing, I could see. He'd waited for the exact moment when the thermals would behave the way he wanted, working with him rather than against him. As he fell deeper, it was almost as if they were nudging him helpfully away from the chasm walls. A screen in the middle of the room was relaying a side-on image of Voronov, captured by what must have been a flying camera chasing him down the chasm. Other diners were following his trajectory with opera glasses, telescopic monocles, and elegant lorgnette binoculars.
"Is there a point to this?" I said.
"Risk," Sibylline said, "and the thrill of doing something new and dangerous. If there's one thing the plague's given us, it's that, the opportunity to test ourselves, to stare death in the face. Biological immortality won't help you much if you've just hit a rock face at 200 kilometers per hour.
Why do they do it, though? Doesn't potential immortality make your lives all the more precious?"
"Yes, but that doesn't mean we still don't need to be reminded of death, now and then. What's the point of beating an old enemy if you deny yourself the thrill of ever remembering what it was like in the first place? Victory loses its meaning without the memory of what you've vanquished."
"But you could die."
She looked up from the menu.
"All the more reason not to cock up your timing, then."
Voronov was nearing the end of his fall. I could barely see him now.
"He's picking up tension now," Fischetti said, "beginning to slow down. See how beautifully he's timed it."
The line was stretched almost to its limit, now starting to arrest Voronov's fall. But his timing was as good as his admirers had evidently been expecting. He disappeared for 3 or 4 seconds, vanishing into the whiteness before the coil began to contract, hauling him back up towards us.
"Textbook," Sibylline said.
There was more applause, but in contrast to before, this time it was wildly enthusiastic. People began to hammer their cutlery in appreciation of Voronov's fall.
"You know what?" Waverley said. "Now that he's mastered mist-jumping, he'll get bored and try something else even more insanely dangerous. You mark my words."
"There goes the other one," Sibylline said, as the last jumper stepped away from the balcony.
"Timing looks good, better than the woman's, anyway. You'd have thought he'd have the decency to let Voronov come back up first, wouldn't you?"
"How will he get back up?" I said.
"He'll haul himself up. There's some kind of motorized winch in his harness."
I watched the last jumper plummet into the depths. To my untrained eye, the jump looked at least as good as Voronov's. The thermals didn't seem to be steering the man towards the sides, and his posture, as he dropped, looked amazingly balletic. The crowd had quietened down now and were watching the fall intently.
"Well, he's no amateur," Fischetti said.
"He just copied Voronov's timing," Sibylline said. "I was watching the way the vortex affected the gliders."
"You can't blame him for that. You don't get marks for originality, you know."
He dropped further still, his harness a glowing green dot receding towards the mist.
"Wait," Waverley said, pointing to the uncoiling line on the balcony. "He should have run out of line by now, shouldn't he?"
"Voronov had by this point," Sibylline agreed.
"Silly fools, given himself too much," Fischetti said. He took a sip from his wine glass and studied the depths with renewed interest. "It's reached the limit now, but it's much too late."
He was right. By the time the glowing green dot reached the level of the mist, it was falling almost as quickly as ever. The screen showed a last, side-on view of him vanishing into the whiteness, and then there was only the taut filament of his line. Seconds passed. First, the 3 or 4 that Voronov had taken before emerging, and then 10, and then 20. By 30 seconds, people were beginning to get a little uncomfortable. Obviously, they had seen this sort of thing happen before, and had some idea of what to expect. Nearly a minute passed before the man emerged. I'd already been told what happened to glider pilots who went too deep, but I hadn't imagined it could be that bad. But the man had gone very far into the mist. The pressure and temperature had been too much for the flimsy protection of his suit. He had died, boiled alive within a few seconds.
The camera lingered on his corpse, lovingly mapping the horror of what had happened to him. I felt revolted and looked away from the image. I'd seen some bad things during my years as a soldier, but never while sitting at a table digesting a large and luxurious meal. Sibylline shrugged. Well, he should have used a shorter line. Afterwards we walked back across the stalk to the landing deck where Sibylline's cable car was still waiting.
Well, Tanner, where can we take you? She said.
I wasn't exactly enjoying their company, I had to admit. It had begun badly, and though I was grateful for the sightseeing trip to the stalk, the cold way they had responded to the deaths of the misjumpers had left me wondering whether I wouldn't have been better off with the pigs they had mentioned. But I couldn't throw away a chance like this. I take it you're heading back to the canopy at some point. She looked pleased. If you want to come with us, it's absolutely no problem. In fact, I insist on it. Well, don't feel any obligation. You've been generous enough as it is. But if it won't inconvenience you...
Not at all. Get in the car.
The vehicle opened before me, Fischetti getting in the driver's compartment and the rest of us in the back. We lofted. The cable car's motion began to feel familiar, if not actually comfortable. The ground dropped away quickly. We reached the interstices of the canopy and settled into a semi-regular rhythm as the car picked its route along one of the main cableways. That was when I started to think I really should have taken my chances with the pigs.
Well, Tanner, did you enjoy your meal? Sibylline asked.
Like you said, it's a hell of a view.
Good. You needed the energy, or at least you will need it.
Deftly, she reached into a compartment set into the car's plush and pulled out a nasty little gun.
Well, to state the obvious, this is a weapon and I'm pointing it at you.
10 out of 10 for observation. I looked at the gun. It appeared to be made out of jade and was embossed with red demons. It had a small dark moor, and she was holding it very steadily.
The point being, Sibylline continued, that you shouldn't think of doing anything untoward.
If you wanted to kill me, you could have done it dozens of times already.
Yes, but there's just one flaw in your thinking. We do want to kill you, just not in any old manner.
I should have felt immediate fear as soon as she pulled out the gun, but there'd been a delay of a few seconds while my mind assimilated the situation and decided it was probably just as bad as it appeared. What are you going to do to me?
Sibylline nodded at Waverley. Can you do it here?
I've got the tools, but I'd far rather do it back at the airship. Waverley nodded at her. You can keep that gun pointed until then, can't you? I asked what they were going to do to me again, but all of a sudden no one seemed very interested in what I had to say. I'd walked into big trouble, that much was obvious. Waverley's story of shooting me to protect me from the pigs hadn't ever sounded more than halfway convincing, but who had I been to argue? I'd kept telling myself that if they had wanted me dead... Nice line, but like Sibylline had said, there was a certain flaw in my thinking. It didn't take very long to reach the trapped airship. As we swung up towards it, I had an excellent view of the imprisoned craft, suspended precariously high above the city. There were no canopy lights anywhere near it, no signs of habitation in the branches that supported it. I remembered what they had said about it being nice and discreet. We landed. By then Waverley had found a gun as well, and when I stepped on to the connecting ramp which led to the gondola, Fischetti was covering me with a third. About the only thing I could have done was jump over the side. But I wasn't that desperate. Not yet. Inside the gondola, I was escorted back to the chair where I had woken up only a couple of hours earlier. This time Waverley strapped me into the seat.
"Well, get on with it," Sibylline said, standing with her hip to one side, with the gun held in one hand like a chic cigarette holder. "It isn't brain surgery, you know."
She laughed. Waverley spent the next few minutes circumnavigating my chair, emitting odd grunts which might have indicated distaste. Now and then he touched my scalp, examining it with gentle fingers. Then, seemingly satisfied, he retrieved some equipment from somewhere behind me. Whatever it was looked medical. "What are you going to do?" I asked, trying again to get a response out of them. "You won't get far by torturing me, if that's what you've got in mind." "You think I'm going to torture you?" Waverley had one of the medical devices in his hand now.
an intricate probe-like thing fashioned from chrome and inset with blinking status lights. It would amuse me, I admit. I'm a colossal sadist, but aside from my own self-gratification, it would serve no purpose. We've trawled your memories, so we know all that you'd tell us under pain. You're bluffing. No, we're not. Did we have to ask your name? No, we didn't. But we knew you were called Tanner Mirabelle, didn't we? You know I'm telling the truth in that case. I have nothing to offer you. He leant closer to me, his lens clicking and whirring as it absorbed visual data across an unguessable spread of the spectrum. We don't really know what to know, Mr. Mirabelle, assuming that's really your name. It's also very foggy in there, you see. Confused memory traces. Hurled swaths of your past which we just can't access. You'll understand that this does not put us in the best possible frame of mind to trust you. I mean, you accept that this is a reasonable response, don't you? I've only just been revived. Ah, yes, and the ice mendicants normally do such a marvelous job, don't they? But in your case, not even their artistry could restore the whole. Are you working for Ryvich? I doubt it. I've never heard of him. He glanced at Sibylline, as if seeking her opinion on the matter. She did her best to mask it, but I saw the way she pulled the facial equivalent of a shrug, a momentary widening of the eyes, as if to say that she hadn't heard of Ryvich either. It looked genuine, too. All right, Waverley said. I think I can do this nice and cleanly. It helps that there aren't any other implants in his head to get in the way. Just do it, Sibylline said. We haven't got all damned night. He held the surgical device against the side of my skull, so that I could feel its cold pressure against my skin. I heard a click, and he pulled a trigger.